Good afternoon. This is Ben Grauer in New York, and here's the news. President Eisenhower, himself a tourist attraction, stopped off at a tourist center in New Hampshire today. The president visited the great stone face atop Cannon Mountain at Franconia Notch, New Hampshire. Standing beneath the huge granite projection, Mr. Eisenhower told an audience of 2,500 persons that only a strong nation can cooperate with others in the cause of true world peace. Weakness cannot cooperate, he said, but can only beg. Only strength can cooperate. Secretary of State Dulles offered Russia's three-point plan for world peace today. The secretary told the UN at San Francisco that there can be peace if Russia does these three things. 1, observe the UN Charter. 2, stop using force. And 3, stop subversion. Dulles ranged over the world in pinpointing the causes of world tension. He said these included such problems as Germany, the communist satellite states of Europe, Red China, world communism, and world disarmament. Briefly, here are the views he expressed on these problems. Germany. The unnatural division of Germany is a grave injustice and an evil which cannot be indefinitely prolonged. The satellites. In Eastern Europe, our nations liberated from one despotism only to be subjected to another in violation of solemn international undertakings. Red China. The Chinese communist regime became an aggressor in Korea, promoted aggression in Indochina, and used force to support its ambitions in the Formosa area. World communism. A worldwide conspiracy to bring into power a form of government which never was freely chosen by the people and which destroys independence. And finally, world disarmament. Soviet acceptance of the American proposal nearly 10 years ago to internationalize atomic energy would have prevented the present competitive production of atomic arms. Immediately following this newscast, NBC will have a special broadcast on the United Nations direct from San Francisco. Russia's Molotov passed out word today that the time of a diplomatic dinner has been changed so that his guests may hear the UN speech of former President Truman tonight before attending the Russian dinner. The Soviets had at first opposed Truman's selection, saying he was a private citizen and represented no government. The administration wants to extend for another year the temporary $281 billion ceiling on the national debt. Treasury Secretary George Humphrey went before the House Ways and Means Committee to request the 12-month extension. He said the government itself must set an example of economy and prudence. A House committee turned its attention today to Navy purchases of a certain soda pop mix, a beverage which was described as anything but popular with most sailors. Chairman Chet Holofield of the Government Operations Subcommittee said that the more than $177,000 involved in the purchase was too much. It shows a lack of control over procurement generally. 3 Navy witnesses said Navy procurement policies were not at fault, that any fault lay in the individuals involved. And a spokesman for the General Accounting Office said the names of the 3 principals in the deal have been turned over to the Justice Department. A handbill has brought havoc to a dog kennel outside Waterloo, Iowa. Persons for miles around delivered hundreds of cats to Newcomb's Kennels, just like a handbill said they should. The handbill said the kennels needed all kinds of cats to help train dogs, and for a limited time, $5 would be paid for every cat brought in. That started the rush. Miles Newcomb, the owner of the kennel, spent hours trying to calm down his dogs once the cats showed up. Later, he told police he didn't know where the handbill came from. Police are looking for the practical joker. And in Washington, 25-year-old Sally Herman made good today. She was auditioning for a concert to be held tomorrow night, and she was accepted. Sally's role will be to bark like a dog in the third movement of Ferdy Groffé's Hudson River Suite. And she beat out some tough competition for the part. 5 real dogs auditioned too, but Sally sounded more like the real thing. Atomic Energy Chief Louis Strauss has announced that President Eisenhower has doubled the amount of enriched uranium available for nuclear research in friendly countries. In a speech in New York, the Atomic Energy Commission chairman said doubling the amount is one more step in Eisenhower's Share the Atom program. Strauss re-emphasized that the fissionable materials which we're prepared to make available as fuel for research reactors will not be of weapons grade. There's the news till now. I'll be back again Monday. Till then, this is Ben Grauer saying good afternoon.
This is the NBC Radio Network.
This is H.V. Kaltenborn. I am speaking to you from the Opera House in San Francisco. We are in the 5th day of the 10th anniversary commemorative meeting of the United Nations. Before discussing today's events with my NBC colleagues, Pauline Frederick, Bill Henry, and Chet Huntley, we will ask you to listen to the most significant passages from this morning's notable address by John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State of the United States.
Today, Yugoslavia is no longer the target of abuse. An orchestrated threat began in 1948 when Yugoslavia asserted its national independence and broke away from alien yoke. During the next 7 years, Yugoslavia was helped military and economically by nations which differed from its government in almost every respect save one, namely the right of Yugoslavia to be a truly independent sovereign nation. Today, the Soviet Union seeks diplomatic and economic relations with the German Federal Republic. That development comes after many years of hostility, during which the Federal Republic was given security and economic support by those who believed in the right of the Germans to have an independent existence under a government of their own choosing. Today, there is a possibility of peace between the Soviet Union and Japan. 4 years ago, in this very room, 49 nations signed the Japanese Peace Treaty, a treaty of reconciliation. I recall, and many of you here today will also recall, how from this very platform that peace was bitterly assailed and rejected by some. But now, as a result of the 1951 Peace Treaty of San Francisco, Japan has resumed a place of honor and dignity in the community of nations, so that some nations now seek peaceful relations which 4 years ago they spurned. Throughout all of these events, there runs a common theme, the theme of fellowship. Those who follow the principles of our charter have helped each other, and by so doing, they have helped themselves. Some say that what has now happened marks the beginning of a new era, and I believe that that can be. Certainly, the United States, I pledge you, will do all that lies within its power to make it so. But we do not forget, we dare not forget, that some of those who now hail the recent developments are precisely those who sought for years to stop them. It is not unprecedented to see men make a virtue of necessity. Today, the necessity for virtue has been created by a stalwart thwarting of efforts to subvert our charter. And if we want to see that virtue continue, I suggest that it may be prudent also to continue what has produced it. Steadfastness to principle and sacrifice for principle are the proven price of the good that we have won. It would be reckless to expect further good at any lesser price. To achieve peace with justice, peace with sovereignty for nations great and small, peace with respect for human beings without regard to class, all of that will require sustaining the effort, the sacrifice, the solidarity which has brought us where we are today. Much has been accomplished, but much, much more remains. There exists the problem of German unification. For 10 years, part of Germany has been severed from the rest. That unnatural division of a great people constitutes a grave injustice. It is an evil which cannot be indefinitely prolonged without breeding more evil to plague the world. In Eastern Europe, our nations many with a long and proud record of national existence, which are in servitude. They were liberated from one despotism only to be subjected to another in violation of solemn international undertakings. In Asia, there is a Chinese communist regime which became an aggressor in Korea, for which it stands condemned by this United Nations. It promoted aggression in Indochina and has used force and the threat of force to support its ambitions in the Taiwan Formosa area. Recent developments, including the influence of the Bandung Conference, suggest that the immediate threat of war may have receded. Let us pray that this is so. But the situation in Asia remains one that cannot be regarded with equanimity. Also, we cannot forget the existence of that apparatus known as international communism. It constitutes a worldwide conspiracy to bring into power a form of government which never, in any country at any time, was freely chosen by the people. At Geneva, at Caracas, at the Caracas Conference last year, the Organization of American States found that the activities of international communism constituted alien intervention in the internal affairs of nations and was a threat to international peace and security. That threat should end. Finally, there's the urgent problem of limiting the crushing burden of armaments. For many years, the United States and its friends have sought to find ways to carry out the mandate of the Charter to reduce the diversion for armaments of the world's human and economic resources. Nearly a decade ago, the United States made a proposal to internationalize atomic energy. This proposal was made by the United States when it was the sole possessor of this weapon. This unprecedented offer, if it had been accepted, would have prevented the present competitive production of these weapons of awesome destructive power, but it was rejected. That proposal was subsequently followed by new proposals for the control and regulation of armaments and the establishment of an international organ to supervise an honest disarmament program. These proposals, too, were spurned. But the Soviet Union recently indicated that it might be prepared seriously to consider the initiative which had been taken months before by other members of the United Nations Disarmament Subcommittee. Let us hope that these indications can be translated into concrete action, making possible limitation of armament on a basis which is in fact dependable and not a fraud. These are some of the problems that confront us as we face the future. They are problems which cannot be met if we shut our eyes to them, or if we are weak, or confused, or divided. There are problems which can be met if we are faithful to the principles of our charter, if we work collectively in fellowship to achieve their application, and if for the future, as in the past, we are prepared to labor and to sacrifice. The United States asks no nation to do what it is not prepared to do itself. Any nation, and I repeat, any nation that bases its actions and attitudes on in international affairs on the principles of the Charter will receive the wholehearted cooperation of the United States. Admittedly, the problems we face are not easy to solve, and they will not be quickly solved. There is room for many honest differences of opinion. But the existence of hard, unsolved problems need not itself be a source of danger and hostility if the nations will bring to the common task the spirit of the Charter. There's one extremely simple method of bringing to an end what is called the Cold War. It is this: observe the Charter of the United Nations. Refrain from the use of force or the threat of force in international relations and from the support and direction of subversion against the institutions of other countries. To bring the Cold War to an end, 7 points are not needed. This one is sufficient. It is in that spirit that we shall next month be going to Geneva for a four-power conference. And we hope we shall find there the spirit of which I speak to be shared. If so, we can find there new procedures, or at least develop a new impetus, which will help to solve some of these vast and stubborn problems that still confront us. We shall not, at this four-power Geneva conference, assume to act as a world directorate with a right to determine the destinies of others. Good solutions do not derive from the illusion of omnipotence. We shall seek to find procedures such that all nations directly concerned in any problem can fully assert whatever rights and whatever views they have.
That was John Foster Dulles speaking here at the San Francisco Opera House this morning. I had a brief chat with him last night at the big reception that he and Ambassador Lodge gave for the other delegates and for a good many people who are gathered here in San Francisco, and commented to him that certainly he did not expect to be gaveled down by Mr. Van Cleffens, and he replied, "Well, I'm not so sure. There's some pretty rough stuff in what I'm going to say. And let's ask my colleagues whether or not they agree that what he has said was rough stuff and what they feel was perhaps the roughest or the most interesting portion of his comment." Pauline Fredericks?
Well, H.V., I think that Mr. Dulles was very firm. Whether I would call it rough or not, I'm not sure. I do think that there is a very significant development here at the United Nations, especially emphasized today. For some time, there has been an emphasis on outside security agreements because there wasn't so much hope of security within the United Nations. Mr. Lester Pearson, in his speech, which preceded that of Secretary Dulles, Mr. Pearson, Secretary for External Affairs of Canada, emphasized the fact that there had to be security sought outside the U.N. because they hadn't found it inside the U.N.
And Mr. Dulles emphasized the same point.
Yes, indeed,
course,
he did. And then Mr. Pearson went on to say that the U.N. had great potentiality that wasn't being used. And then Mr. Dulles emphasized particularly the fact that the United Nations, cooperation under the United Nations, was the spirit in which they were going to the Big Four meeting at Geneva, which to me indicates a return to the importance of the United Nations in the thinking of the statesmen of the world.
Bill Henry, what's your reaction?
Well, H.V., I was quite fascinated by following the delivery of the speech and noting the care with which the speech had not only been written, but rewritten. There were any number of interpolations and changes of words and changes of phrases designed to bring out the very specific meaning. It was very obvious to me that this had been very carefully prepared as an answer to all the arguments that the Molotov had presented, and that he wanted to be very specific and very careful about everything that was said, because it seemed to me that there was no page went by in his prepared script without at least two or three very obvious and very clarifying changes that had been made to make it a little more sharp in its meaning and in its reply to Molotov.
Chet Huntley?
I thought the speech certainly was not rough. It was pointed, and as Pauline says, it was certainly firm. There was no vituperation in the speech at all. Furthermore, there was, as
you may...
Of course,
rough stuff, as a man of clerical derivation like Mr. Dulles describes it, is something different from the way you and I would describe it.
That's quite true. And furthermore, there was no precise formula, you may have noticed, in Mr. Dulles' speech, but there certainly was a general plea in behalf of an international code of ethics, or that's another way of saying a system of living by the terms of the Charter. And that was brought out in that one line of his, I think, which we heard a moment ago. And he said it doesn't take a seven-point program to end the Cold War. It just takes one, a bit of living by the Charter. In other words, the spirit and the language of the Charter is here. It's down on paper. It was rather well written in 1945. It's well constructed. It's all there. So a bit of abiding by it would help matters considerably.
My own feeling was that it was a complete answer to Molotov and that was its prime purpose. And I was naturally delighted, as I'm sure we all were, that Mr. Dulles did not let anything get by. He just went at that Mullis statement, paragraph by paragraph, and pointed up the answer, and pointed up in the way that every lover of freedom and of democracy wants it pointed up, especially on an occasion of this kind, where the publicity is of such tremendous importance. Now, I was struck particularly with his emphasis on the importance of the Western collective security pacts, meaning that those are going to continue, irrespective of what happens. Also, he pointed that the Soviet peace moves are due not to necessarily to a change of policy, that they're getting religion, as we might call it, but to the fact that the action of the Western powers has been successful in every field. The action against aggression. He cited Korea, and I have felt that Korea wasn't cited enough in this meeting. He definitely pointed up that Korean aggression had been stopped, and stopped by the united action of the 15 nations that fought together against aggression. He cited Indochina, Yugoslavia, the Soviet moves in Germany, Soviet seeking peace with Japan, and then he said these are due to the fact that the Western nations have stood together, that they have organized themselves, and that their collective security is real, and it's real because of their unity and their common beliefs.
Well, so, among other things, H.B., don't you think the strategy of that is based on this premise, that if it is the purpose of the Soviet Union now, by this new behavior of theirs, to weaken the alliances and to throw awry the Western alliance and NATO and the other pacts and organizations, then our State Department and the Western nations are merely getting prepared for it and meeting it in advance.
Well, now, Pauline has called our attention to the fact that Mr. Dulles points to the four-power conference at Geneva. And, Bill Henry, what do you think is going to be the effect of all that has happened here on the meeting of our top representatives in Geneva?
Well, I'm not dead certain. It's perfectly clear that we haven't weakened at all, and we don't seem to have any great optimism as to what may develop in Geneva. We're willing to talk, but we're not overwhelmed with the idea that we're going to go there and rewrite the world or rewrite the Charter or rewrite anything. We are simply going to meet the threat as it is proposed and as it apparently exists through its reiteration by Mr. Molotov in his speech.
Pauline, don't you think that Mr. Dulles' statement that we must expect no quick action on any of these great problems is an indication that we don't hope for too much from Geneva?
I think it's an indication that we're being very realistic about the meeting at the summit, which I think is helpful. At the same time, Mr. Dulles, as President Eisenhower did on Monday, kept the door wide open for any possibilities that might lead to some sort of settlement, because he reiterated, as you recall, President Eisenhower's statement in which he said, "The United States will leave no stone unturned to work for peace. We shall reject no method, however novel, that holds out any hope, however faint, for a just and lasting peace."
That was his final phrase.
Yes, and in spite of the fact that he was firm on the need for alliances at the present time because the world has not found peace and we need security, nevertheless, he said, "Here is the opportunity and the United States will consider any reasonable proposal, even any novel proposal," as the president has put it.
Chet Huntley, any comment?
Well, Mr. Dulles' speech certainly demonstrated, and this whole week has demonstrated to us, as a matter of fact, that this is not the place where the specific problems of the Cold War and a divided world are going to be taken up and probed and tested, and the knots are going to be untied a bit. As Krishna Menon told me a little while ago, he said this isn't a conference, that this is actually a series of 60 testimonials in behalf of a more decent world. Well, if that be true, we may hope that the four delegates will go to the Geneva conference and be somewhat responsive to the pressures of world opinion. Now, true, world opinion hasn't had much influence on the Soviet Union in the past decade, but maybe it takes a long time, and we certainly may hope that at long last it will have some telling effect. It's maybe too early to tell.
It may be this public opinion is having an effect on the Soviet Union now, and that's the reason we are getting some indications of a more cooperative attitude than there has been
in the past. That's a very good point. I'm confident that this must have an effect on the Soviet Union through a man like Molotov, who comes here and is subjected to world opinion. Well, it may be, as you say, as Menon said, a testimonial by 60 nations of their desire for a more decent world, but I'm very happy that it included one or two vigorous testimonials as to the indecencies of the world in which we live.
Yes. H.V., I thought that it was very striking that Mr. Dulles took each of the attempts which were made by Molotov the other day to sort of gloss over the reasons. Molotov cited all these wonderful things that the Russians are doing now as though they were evidences of a great loving heart, and they loved the people and they loved peace. And today, Mr. Dulles went to the trouble to point out exactly why each of these things happened. So they were made to happen, that these things happen not because of any great will for peace, but because the circumstances and the opposition, the strong opposition of the free nations, had forced the Russians to make some changes, the communists to make some changes in their attitude.
I felt that Lester Pearson, in his very able address this morning, the representative of Canada as its foreign minister, he really pointed out what sort of havoc the Soviet Union and its representatives have made of the English language, and presumably even of their own, when he said too many good words of respectable parentage, democracy, coexistence, freedom, appeasement, human rights, popular, and above all peace-loving, have been turned upside down and inside out and made to seem what they are not. What we need is a convention for the defense of peace-loving words against verbal aggression. There's a marvelous phrase.
A wonderful phrase.
And he goes on, when the representative of the Soviet Union says, as he did on Wednesday, that those who pay lip service to the principle of peaceful coexistence sometimes tend to violate that principle flagrantly in practice. And Pearson added, I could not agree with Molotov more. Any satisfaction or comfort I secure from that agreement, however, is removed by the certainty that we could hardly disagree more on who are meant by those.
Well, by the way, I have long felt that Lester Pearson of Canada is one of the most underrated statesmen in the world. He's always good for an excellent top-rate performance.
Yes, I've played baseball with him even and interviewed him. I was a little disappointed on his attitude towards China, which is, of course, more in accord with Britain's attitude than it is with ours. But at the same time, he presents it so reasonably that it's hard to quarrel with a man like Lester Pearson. And that's what we need, I think, is the kind of approach that you get from men of that stamp. Now, is it possible that Molotov can be converted to that kind of an approach?
I like Pearson's line today where he said that the Russians were asking for coexistence, insisting on coexistence. He says what the world needs is not coexistence, but cooperation.
Now, this is H.V. Kaltenborn speaking also for my colleagues, Pauline Frederick, Bill Henry, and Chet Huntley, bringing to a close the final report in this series by NBC News on the 10th anniversary meeting of the United Nations, direct from the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco.
One moment, please. This is the NBC Radio Network.